The Cloister and the Hearth by Charles Reade. Chapter 1. Not a day passes over the earth, but men and women of no note do great deeds, speak great words, and suffer noble sorrows. Of these obscure heroes, philosophers, and martyrs, the greater part will never be known till that hour when many that are great shall be small, and the small great. But of others the world's knowledge may be said to sleep. Their lives and characters lie hidden from nations in the annals that record them. The general reader cannot feel them. They are represented so curtly and coldly. They are not like breathing stories appealing to his heart, but little historic hailstones striking him but to glance off his bosom. Nor can he understand them. For epitomes are not narratives, as skeletons are not human figures. Thus records of prime truths remain a dead letter to plain folk. The writers have left so much to the imagination, and imagination is so rare a gift. Here, then, the writer of fiction may be of use to the public as an interpreter. There is a musty chronicle, written in intolerable Latin, and in it a chapter where every sentence holds a fact. Here is told with harsh brevity the strange history of a pair who lived untrumpeted and died unsung 400 years ago, and lie now as unpitied in that stern page as fossils in a rock. Thus, living or dead, fate is still unjust to them. For if I can but show you what lies below that dry chronicler's words, methinks you will correct the indifference of centuries, and give those two sore-tried souls a place in your heart for a day. It was past the middle of the 15th century. Louis XI was sovereign of France, Edward IV was wrongful king of England, and Philip the Good, having by force and cunning dispossessed his cousin Jacqueline and broken her heart, reigned undisturbed this many years in Holland, where our tale begins. Elias and Catherine, his wife, lived in the little town of Tergu. He traded, wholesale and retail, in cloth, silk, brown holland, and above all in curried leather, a material highly valued by the middling people, because it would stand 20 years' wear and turn an ordinary knife, no small virtue in a jerkin of that century, in which folk were so liberal of their steel. Even at dinner a man would leave his meat awhile and carve you his neighbour, on a very moderate difference of opinion. The couple were well-to-do, and would have been free from all earthly care but for 9 children. When these were coming into the world, 1 per annum, each was hailed with rejoicings, and the saints were thanked, not expostulated with, and when parents and children were all young together, the latter were looked upon as lovely little playthings invented by heaven for the amusement, joy, and evening solace of people in business. But as the olive branches shot up, and the parents grew older, and saw with their own eyes the fate of large families, misgivings and care mingled with their love. They belonged to a singularly wise and provident people. In Holland, reckless parents were as rare as disobedient children. So now, when the huge loaf came in on a gigantic trencher looking like a fortress in its moat, and the tour of the table once made seemed to have melted away, Elias and Catherine would look at one another and say, "Who is to find bread for them all when we are gone?" At this observation, the younger ones needed all their filial respect to keep their little Dutch countenances, for in their opinion, dinner and supper came by nature, like sunrise and sunset. And so long as that luminary should travel round the earth, so long as the brown loaf go round their family circle and set in their stomachs.